everyone. Welcome all. Step right up. Step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Portal Gaming Podcast, episode number 128 is here. Howdy, everybody. Portal Gaming Podcast is a podcast brought to you by a store called The Portal, which is located in Manchester, Connecticut. For more information, you can log on to www.timemachineportal.com. Check us out on Facebook, The Portal, and on Twitter, at PortalGaming60. Portal Game Podcast is also a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. I am your host for this episode, The Brant, and this one is entitled, Before Creation, There Were Six Singularities. We're going to be talking about six-player games, some games that I like that play with six. And we'll get to that a little later in the episode and give you a little bit more of the rundown on that. Hello, everybody. It's great to talk to you. I am in my car on a decent drive across Connecticut here in the rain. So I figured what a better time than now to take a chance to talk with all of you. And it's a great episode. I've got some really new, hot, and upcoming games that I'm going to recount recent plays of, review for you here, so that should be really interesting, really good, and I'm excited to talk about them. It's always my favorite part, talking about games on the podcast, so that'll be fun. Next stop, Dice Tower Con, Orlando, Florida, next week. For me, it's just me, nobody else is going with me. I am solamente. I'll be hanging out with the crew from This Game Is Broken, staying with them and gaming with them and whatnot, kind of working a little bit of the con, Dice Tower Rewards, and teaching in the hot games area, the main two things for me, and just generally being around. It's a great con. It's a fun time. Can't wait to go to Orlando in July. But that'll be my next stop, and then the crew is going to Gen Con. Everybody but Kathy will be headed that way. So that'll be Larry, Brian, and myself. Lots of other Connecticut people, I'm sure, but that'll be the main constituents. So, yeah, that's what's happening with me. That's what's going on. Hey, I just want to take a quick moment to mention, like, a lot of times I'll say I on this show. Like, oh, I received this game, or I did this, or I'm excited to be here. And obviously there's times where I am just talking about myself, but it goes without mentioning to some sense, but you know, what Brian and Kathy do for the show, what Larry's doing at the store, a couple other people like Mike who works down there, even just in the receiving games, the playing games with me, all that stuff is kind of behind the scenes, if you will, on the podcast, but they are regularly interacting with me and allowing me to be able to do this. So it really is a we whenever I say I, and obviously some of the voices are on there that I mentioned. Another big one lately has been Matt Bartlett. Been playing a lot. Matt does a lot of stuff for our Facebook group and website things. I suppose as well as being married to Jen, the board game librarian. But he does a lot down at the store as well. So I just thought it was a good chance to mention that, that this is not just me. I am really just hired to be the voice of this whole thing. Or just in charge of all that. And there's a lot of people that go into allowing me to talk about the games or being on the episodes or receiving games or helping me with shipment and contact and all sorts of other things and game nights and whatnot, and just the store side of everything. So thanks to all of them for being part of this 128 episodes. I don't know. People say, who would have thought we'd get this far? I pretty much planned on going this far. So, you know, it's not to be cocky or arrogant or anything, but I got another 128 in me easy, so let's keep doing this. It's fun. You know, I guess part of my strategy, I did that State of the Podcast a few episodes ago, is just to make it fun. I don't have a deadline. I know consistency is important, so I try to be every week. At some point, kind of pops up. You know, a couple of them that I listen to, it's kind of fun, like, ooh, they have one, or ooh, they have two this week. Okay, that's exciting. So I'm kind of on that front. I try to make sure there's something to talk about. If not, then, you know, it's those 30-minute episodes where we want to just fill you in on what was happening, but not waste your time talking to you for 2 hours or an hour and a half or whatever it be, like a, you know, hour full-long episode. So keep them a little shorter if there's not too much. But this one is not one of those. I've got a lot to talk about here. And away we go with games recently played. I'm going to start with a super surprising game, both in the fact of I received a copy of this and the play was excellent. Really enjoyed this game. So this is called Undaunted, and this is from Osprey. So they sent us a copy of this to play. I believe it releases in August, so I assume it'll be in the store in August and probably also available at Gen Con. So basically what Undaunted is, it is a two-player deck-building war game. So we've seen a few things like this. We've definitely seen card-driven games, right, from GMT and stuff like that that are war games, but this really is a deck builder. You're adding cards, you're subtracting cards, you're shuffling your deck, going through it regularly every couple turns, and resetting it. And you're basically playing through the battles of Normandy. So I played this, I played the first scenario, and then I played with Larry the fifth scenario. I jumped. The reason I jumped is I wanted to kind of add everything in, and I think that was really key for this game. So basically how it plays out is each player draws four cards in a round to start the round, and then you bid with one of those cards. So you play the cards, they all have an initiative value in the corner. Whoever plays the highest gets the initiative. If it's a tie, the initiative stays where it is. That player will then play their other three cards out, and then let the other player go. End of round, discard your cards, grab new cards, and repeat. And you just keep doing that until the end game objectives are achieved. So the end game tends to be something like capture these objective points, pin your opponent, which usually means remove certain units from the board if they're gone, create a situation where they couldn't move, I guess. That's a majority of them. So your deck contains different platoons, and within those you've got like machine gunners and riflemen, which are kind of your main unit, and snipers and scouts, as well as you have cards that like really don't apply to any. They're kind of like generals and leaders and platoon sergeants and things like that. So I don't remember the specific names of them all. And so when you play a card, it generally has 2 to 4 actions on it, and you pick which action you want to do, and you do that action. So it might be move, it might be scout. So the difference between move and scout is you have to scout first. So if you haven't been to a tile, the board is made up of modular tiles. If you haven't been to a tile, you have to send a scout there, and you can place a token that you've scouted that region. That token can then be changed to a control token later, so that you kind of control that region. And when you scout a tile, you grab a Fog of War card and throw it in your deck. It is a one initiative, nothing card, so it just makes for dead space in your hand. But you can also use your scouts to get rid of those cards, or add those to your opponent's deck. So it's kind of interesting on that front. The Riflemen move. Pretty much everything move. No, some things can move more than one tile now that I think about it. They control location, so if you put them on a location and flip it, flip the token, you can control that, which is generally an end game objective. And they can attack. Many of the units can attack. So how do you attack in this game? It's really simple. You can attack anything, so you're always within range, which I love. You look at the unit you want to attack. It has a base defense value. You add the defense of the tile that it's in. So if I was attacking like a scout, that was defense 4. It's in a wooded region, so that's got 1. Now it's a 5, and then I count my distance. I'm 2 away, 6, 7. Roll a 10-sided die. If I roll a 7, 8, 9, or 10, it's a hit. There are opportunities to roll multiple dice, but multiple dice just increase your chance to hit because you have more. So let's say I rolled 4 dice. If any of them come up as a 7, 8, 9, or 10, I score a hit. I don't score multiple hits. That's important for things like suppression and mortar, which tend to have a lot. Suppression fire is just, you don't damage the unit, but you flip the token over, and their next action must be to flip over. So you kind of slow them down. And so it's key that that's easier to hit, but not as powerful as dealing damage. When you deal damage to a unit, the owner looks in their hand and gets rid of a card from the game. Otherwise, they look in their discard pile. Otherwise, they look in their deck. If there's no cards for that unit anywhere, then they have to remove the token from the board. And that's how it works. Then there's opportunities like those platoon sergeants and things. They can go in. They have a thing called, they have Inspire and Bolster. Inspire lets me pick up a card and play it again, so that unit can kind of go twice. bolster is I can pull cards into my deck. So there's no cost to buying cards in this game. There's just a card you have to play and do that. There's also, like, your main one. I'm sorry, I don't remember the names of them right now. And your main, like, general or whatever allows you to do what's called command, where you can just draw those cards straight in your hand and use them immediately. But, of course, it only comes up once through your deck cycle that you have those. That's basically it. That's what you're doing. Like I said, there's mortars that can attack at a different range. They kind of have to target. And all sorts of different units. There's snipers that... the snipers hit at long range? No, I guess they just have a higher attack value, so they're more likely to hit at the longer range because they have better chance. And things like that. And you just kind of play through. So I do think that the basic scenario for most gamers will be too basic. So this is kind of reminding me of Harry Potter, Hogwarts Battle, the deck builder, where the complaint was people played the first three and they're like, this game is so basic and way too long. And it is at the first three. They tell you in the book, hey, if you're a gamer, jump higher. They don't do that in Undaunted. They have you kind of play through the stories, but I do think it's worth it to jump. Like, I think it's okay to play the first one and kind of learn and then just jump to number five was a really good one, I thought, for doing that, and I would suggest that for gamers. You know, you're probably going to want to go back and play the other ones as well, or teach other people using those or whatnot. Great game, 45 minutes to an hour, which I think is part of what makes this game good, so I mentioned the time frame on that. I don't remember the price point on the game. The tokens are good. They're solid tokens. They're not chintzy. The tiles are good. The cards are good. I mean, if you're going to be an avid player, you're probably going to sleeve them. But yeah, that's what's happening. I really, really like Undaunted. It was a little unexpected, and I know that this has been getting played around the shop, and people have really been enjoying it. So, looking forward to that one releasing in August. Next up, I got to play Lanterns Dice. So Lanterns Dice is the dice game version, or the roll and write version of Lanterns, from Renegade Game Studios. Lantern is kind of the releasing of all the Chinese lanterns and the festivals they have around all that. So what happens in Lanterns Dice is, it's a roll and write game, like I said. So you will, on your turn, you'll roll the four dice. They kind of give you a bin, and different colored lanterns will come up. And you kind of take the bin that collects the dice, and there's four of them, and you aim one at each player. So I might get a red lantern, and then I'm giving Zephra a blue and Kathy a green. That's who I played with. So that's kind of the idea there of what's happening. And everybody gets to color in. What you have is you have a grid of squares, and each square is cut in half as a triangle. And those triangles are what you can color. They're the different colored lanterns. So when you're given a lantern type, you color that in. And now you have that half a triangle. When you fill in a whole square, some of them give you bonuses. Some are just to be able to place some tiles later on. So what are the bonuses you can get? You can get gifts. You can get platforms, which allow you to immediately color another section nearby. And there are boats that you don't want to color in. You want to surround them by coloring them in. And that's kind of the idea. So then on your turn, you can optionally spend those gifts. There are kind of some cards that come out. They're double-sided, so there's different abilities. But there's things like color in another platform of the color you just did, or color in all the other dice as well. Things like this that you can use. And then last on your turn, you can put off a firework display. So basically, you're trying to make Tetris shapes, right? Polyominoes. You're trying to make Tetris shapes in the patterns that you're coloring in. And when you fully color one in, you can pull one of these pieces off the top of the stack, and it will score points. And the stacks start at high and go to low numbers. So a higher stack might be 6, 5, 5, 4, 4, 4, 3. Another stack that's a little bit smaller might be 4, 3, 3, 2, 2, 2, 2, all the way to the end, or whatever it is. So you're doing all that. You play 10 turns, which is everybody gets a chance to roll. And you go, oh, sorry, it's based on number of players. So I think we played 10 in 3-player. I think you might play 8 in 2-player, whatever it is. But a round is just one person rolling, and you go around whatever number of times. Also, when it's your turn, you get to color in a free spot, which is on your sheet. One thing that was nice is they made, like, 4 different sheets in the box. So it's kind of nice you get a different sheet each time. I feel like it would have been nice if it was even more varied from that. But, I mean, I get it. At the point that they offered that many... you know, they've done a good job in terms of that. It was fine. It just wasn't anything amazing to me. I'm not the Roland Wright person. They're all fun, and I don't have a problem playing them. If somebody says, come on, let's play this Roland Wright, you know, I'm in. But I didn't find anything super clever or super fun in this one. It was neat when your plan all came together, like, ooh, I'm going to color that now on Zephyr's turn, and then I'll get, hopefully Kathy will roll this, or I can gain this bonus, and then on my turn I'm going to get this freebie, and I'll pick this color. And when that happened, that made me feel clever, so I enjoyed that piece. It was like 25 minutes, but I just, there was no reason to play it over other Roland Wrights to me. It can't even be played with unlimited players, which is kind of a draw to me in Roland Wrights. It's a four-player game or less, I suppose. Does it have solo in the box? I don't remember. I apologize. I'm usually pretty good about also playing the solo, but I didn't in this case. However, I had borrowed it from the store, and I then returned it to the store. And the next day after I did that, Zephyr said, where's that Lantern's Dice game? I really want to play that again. I had fun with that. It was really pretty. So Zephyr enjoyed it more so than I did. She was looking forward to playing again. We actually dug out Lanterns, which I had. We were going to play that, but we ended up playing Adventureland instead. But we're going to play Lanterns soon. So that was that. But that is Lantern's Dice from Renegade Game Studios. Next up, I got a chance to play Revolution of 1828. This is the new Stefan Feld game, also from Renegade Game Studios. It's a two-player only game about the campaign for president in 1828, which, you know, had a lot of muckraking and all that kind of stuff. I can't remember what the term they use here, but, you know, a lot of attacking each other, attacking the other candidate. And the game is not very thematic. I would say it's not thematic at all. You are trying to garner the most votes. It's not even based on electoral college or anything like that. It's just whoever gets the most votes, so votes or points. You play four rounds, and you put three tokens out in all these different regions of the country, you know, New England and northeast and southeast and whatever it is, Midwest, as well as you put tokens in the newspaper or the editor region. On your turn, you pull a token. Many of them are just elector or delegates, and you gain the delegate to the side, and they're color-coded to what region they go in. Some of them give you, like, a special ability token, and then some of them are that, you know, throwing slime at the other person, all that kind of stuff. I'm sorry, I can't think of the name right now in terms of all that. But you collect these tokens, and they're kind of a wild token, but then they work against you. They're going to make you give up points later on. If you pull the last token from a region, you get the elector. There's a little colored meeple standing on the space, and you get that one, and you get to take another turn. So that's kind of, you're kind of playing that game of chicken with the other player in terms of who's going to pull what at what time and gain what bonuses. At the end of the round, you then look. Whoever has a majority gets a vote in each of the regions. If you have any tokens and the other player has none, you get two votes. And if you have the elector, you get one vote for every delegate you have, regardless of whether you won. So the ultimate thing would be to have three or four, win that one, your opponent has none, and then you'd get two votes plus the four. You get like six votes in that region. Would kind of be the idea, although it randomly determines, you know, you draw from a bag and it doesn't reset each round. Then you look for whoever has the editor, and they have to give a vote for each of those negative tokens that they have. So they have to give up votes. Play four rounds, most votes wins. Kathy strongly disliked the game. She disliked it mid-game. She disliked it end-game. I told her to come on and share her thoughts, and she wasn't really interested in trying to put down a game. Just, it wasn't for me, and I'm happy to not play it, and we move it on. That's kind of her thought on not enjoying a game. She doesn't need to pontificate about that. I will pontificate a little bit. I did think that there was merit and that it was clever in terms of what I'm going to pick. If I really didn't see something, it was super frustrating. Like, oh my gosh, as soon as I take that, there are ones that allow you to, like, steal delegates from other players. Oh, and then you're going to take the one that steals one from me, of course. And that can definitely be frustrating, but it also leads to you feeling a little bit clever. I did feel like the whole negative tokens thing was just really punishing, because you could try to almost force the other player to end up with that editor, newspaper editor, and then just hand you, and it just steamrolled. And I know in our situation, Kathy was scoring less points and handing me points, so she wasn't really gaining a benefit from any of that. The extra tokens were definitely necessary, like the ones that weren't the negative ones, or the smear tokens. It's a smear campaign. It just came to me. So those negative tokens, or the black tokens, are called smear tokens, or a smear campaign. But there are also these other tokens that do all sorts of random effects, and they're really important to the game. Really key that they're in there. So I'm glad they were there, because they definitely add some of that variety. There is some variety in the game, but it's kind of like, oh, if three yellow tokens come up from New England and two blue come from the Midwest, then the next round there's one blue and none from New England, so it didn't really create a lot of variety. So it wasn't really a game I was interested in playing again. It was 30 minutes, but there's so many great two-player games with Seven Wonders Duel and Patchwork and just all the Dueling Wizard battle card games and Battle Line. It just doesn't have a place. It doesn't, unless you collect two-player games or you're particularly interested in the historical aspect, which the book has a bunch of stuff, but the game doesn't have anything. It's a pass. It's not interesting. There's not much here. The Steffenfeld is going to be the part that's going to draw people, and the Renegade. The production is fine. There's nice round tokens in a bag to put them in. I got nothing more to say. I'm moving on. That is Revelation of 1828. Nope. Revolution of 1828. From Renegade Game Studios. Next up, another Roll and Write, Imperial Settlers Roll and Write. So Imperial Settlers is a game from Portal Games. The Roll and Write is also from Portal Games, designed by Ignacy Trebicek. Always have a soft spot for Portal, since they're our name too. And gotten to meet and talk to Ignacy, who's super nice, many times. So Imperial Settlers Roll and Write is a Roll and Write version of this. You're trying to score the most points over 10 rounds. They always tend to be this. Even my favorite Roll and Write Fleet the Dice game is 10 rounds. So there's something magical about 10 rounds. So what happens on a round? It's a civilization game. You're building up a civilization. The first player rolls the four dice. One of them determines how many actions everybody's going to have for that round. The other three determine the resources, which are wood, food, stone, and coins, which are wild. So these are the resources that you are able to collect. You then draft these tiles from the center. One of the tiles gives you an additional action. One of them gives you a coin, which is a wild resource. One does this feature where you can harvest from your lands. You can harvest everything of one type. So I'll talk about that in a second. You then immediately spend your actions and resources. Nothing can be held over, so you do have to remember in your head. The game does give you a spot, like a little square that you can write in. You can write your number of actions, and I was drawing the resources I had and crossing them out so I could remember. Kind of reminded me of Harvest Dice and drawing all those little shapes. And you spend them. You can. There's kind of four tracks along the top that represent your granary, your walls, your houses, and your bridges. So it takes an action to cross off a box. In addition, you have to have the resources. So a box may contain two food tokens. So it will cost one of your actions and two food resources to be able to cross off that box. So both actions and resources are a limiting factor, which was definitely a nice part of the game and clever as well. So you kind of go through and you cross off these boxes. Those rows on your sheet basically are trying to get you to score points. The further up you move, the more points you're going to score at the end of the game. You're just going to track how far you were on that and score points at the end of the game. The bridges, however, down below allow you to kind of open up regions. So the bottom section has regions with stuff you can harvest. So you kind of uncover two spaces, and the bridges are really cheap to build. They're either empty, or they just have like a single stone in them, or maybe a single wood. And when you use the bridge, you uncover a region, and now you can spend an action, bubble that in, and you harvest an apple that you can use that round, or wood, or whatever it is. And as you get further into the land, you might get like 2 stone, or 2 coins, or even more, as you unlock those. So you're kind of choosing to do that. So that part was nice in terms of like a little engine build, or opening up your options on a turn so that resources wouldn't be as limiting. Also, that tile I told you that seemed really important to use at some point was basically you can use that and say, I'm going to harvest all of my apples. So everywhere I have apples, I got 1 here, 1 here, 2 here. So that gives me 4 apples this turn to use. So you can kind of take a big turn moving forward in that space. You have a separate sheet that gives you buildings. So buildings are going to give you things like you just gain an apple every turn. Or if the dice come up all different, oh, I wish I could remember which one was which, you get a coin this round. Or an extra action, I think. If 2 things come up the same, you get another coin this round to be able to spend. So those buildings were definitely useful because they give you a lot of flexibility. And then in the advanced game, which is the one we played, as you bubble in that, as you cross off boxes in that grid on your first sheet, you can then build the buildings, they're called settlements, from the second sheet. So if I build a farm might be like a little L shape, and if I cross off boxes on my first sheet, I can then circle those to put another farm, and instead of my farm producing 1 apple, it'll produce 2 apples or food each round. So that was kind of a neat element. It was very easy to throw in for gamers, I felt like, on that mode. So that's kind of what you're doing. You go through the 10 rounds, you're spending your actions, you're trying to build these, and you score your points at the end. It was nice and easy. Everything's laid out really nicely, and you add up your points and score. I liked it. I liked it more than Lantern's Dice and some of the other Roll and Writes. But again, it just didn't have that arc. Like, it kind of had an engine build, but the arc was so low. It didn't have, like, a high point coming down to a low point. Lots of things. It definitely made me feel clever. The production is great. I love the sheets. I like, they give it, like, this pencil-drawn design, so things aren't, like, the circles don't fully complete themselves. It looks like somebody circled it. And, like, there's kind of, like, some scribble marks. That was really nice in terms of the production. The dice are nice. They're wooden dice. I don't know if that matters to people, good or bad. But I thought they were fine. They're very light to throw. And you're drafting. But, again, yeah, like I said, it just didn't quite have that arc to it. Like, I didn't feel like I was doing a lot. I felt like I was just going to do this, and this was my plan. And I'm kind of hoping the dice work, or I chose both of those actions with dice, so either way I was getting a bonus. I just kind of hedged my bet instead of increasing it. And it felt like there were these architects. What was the architect? You could build an architect building or something, settlement. And they were just worth 8 points, and they just felt like you just had to go for them over like building up your engine. And it's kind of nice when you can only do those later in the game or whatever. But yeah, that was that. It comes with a 48-sheet solo play campaign. Now that's got me highly interested, because I can only imagine if it's a campaign, if you're building things up, I can play this solo. I mean, the game again was like 20-25 minutes. If I'm playing this solo, maybe knocking it out in 15-20, I could play 3 of those in an hour and cruise through that. It would be used up. I know Sue Sheldon from the Dice Tower laminated all those sheets so she could play the campaign again. That part's got me intrigued for sure. But again, it's a Roll and Write on a pile of Roll and Writes. You know, if people said pick one of these 3, I'd probably be likely to pick it over a lot of others. Is it limited? It is limited in the number of players it can play, which I believe is 1 to 5, because there are 5 tiles. That's it. Imperial Settlers Roll and Write from Portal Games. Next up, I want to talk about Pipeline. Pipeline is from Capstone Games, and this is a big, meaty, economic Euro game. So what's happening in Pipeline is the government decides they need to privatize all these oil pipelines, and they're going to sell off all the oil pipelines to private owners, and that's you as the players. Pipeline will play 2 to 4, and what you are doing is it's kind of a worker placement action selection. You get 1 worker you can place out and pick an action, and you can go where other players are. So to me, that's not worker placement, but you are putting a meeple, and you're trying to have the most money at the end of the game. The game takes place over 3 years. Years have a certain number of turns, and it actually changes. I want to say it's like 12-8-4 or 10-6-4, something like that. Year one has 10 actions, and it comes down from there. I don't remember exactly what it is. You're going to get money for all sorts of things, but mainly buying, refining, and selling oil is what you're trying to do. And there are different types of oil, which I don't know oil super well, but I would imagine you've got gasoline, you've got kerosene, you've got home heating oil, you've got diesel. I would imagine these are some of the oil. They're just represented as blue, orange, and gray cubes in the game. The game is really good. I will start there. I've only played it once. I feel like this game absolutely warrants multiple plays and probably is most appreciated by playing multiple times. So if it's kind of something you're going to dabble on a game night one time and not get back to, I could see your play not being super engaging the first time or going, oh my gosh, I didn't realize this. There is a lot to calculate, a lot of math. The interaction isn't super high in the game, and I think that's what led to me doing very well. I won the game, and math without interaction is something I can generally do very well. I don't mind interaction, but it mucks things up, and it makes it so I get very nervous about how people are going to, you know, perceive how I'm doing and attack, and I play conservative, and it doesn't always work out. So there's that piece. Anyway, so in Pipeline, you choose these actions. So you have actions which are like gain tanks and pipes, or gain contracts that you have to complete. You can pull contracts or take out a loan, which you need to do. And you're trying to basically gain pipes, that you build a tableau of pipes on the side. And the pipes are also colored red, orange, blue, and gray, and you gain these pipes. A lot of people say it reminds them of the old Milton Bradley Waterworks game. The pipes are kind of going all different places. You've got six different like entrances or exits on the tile. They're kind of these longer tiles. And you're trying to connect up the pipes and kind of make a pipe that has certain number of connections. Like they've got little sections on them, and you want it to be as many sections or a bunch of pipes. There's many different ways to play, so it's not a this is what you want to do. There's lots of things you can do. But you're building this tableau. You can also get the pipes directly from the government. So you open up sectors. There's like four quadrants, and you can open them up as the game goes on. Two in the first round, then there'll be three available in the second year, and all four will be available in the fourth year. You can also gain upgrades that allow you to do things different or give you free things every round. And then there are machines. So machines allow you to run your pipes by paying, and you can refine fuel. You can also put your meeple on your pipe segments to refine that fuel. Okay, let's try to go through a little bit more of that. So you're picking an action on your turn. Basically, everything costs money. So you're really limited on your money in the beginning, and you're trying to create a system to give yourself money to buy more things to then gain money at the end of the game. So if money is points, you're also spending points, which is really fun. It's a great way for economic games to work. As well. So in the middle there, when you take one of those actions, you can also pay $10, which I assume is like $10 million or $10,000, to move to an adjacent space and use that space as well. The other spaces that are on there just shop at the crude oil market or the refined market, where you can both buy and sell. Crude oil is the basic oil, so it's very cheap. It costs 5, 7, 10, things like this, to buy a barrel of oil. You then store it on your tanks, and your tanks are sectioned by like crude, low quality, mid grade, and high grade oil. You then need to refine it. That's what your pipes allow you to do. So based on the number of sections of pipes, that determines how far you can refine your oil. And at the start of the game, you randomize tiles that tell you what it takes to take orange crude oil from being crude to being low grade, or low grade to mid grade. So those numbers are somewhere 4, 5, 6, and then it tells you in later games to use 7. So you need large sections to be able to move those up. So it may take me like 12 or 14 or even more to move crude oil all the way up to high grade oil. So that's going to take some time and some money to be able to do. You can take any of those secondary actions and kind of work your way through. So that's basically the idea of what you're trying to do. You're trying to buy items that allow you to refine fuel and then go to those refined markets and sell it, or complete those contracts that you can sell them for a little bit more guaranteed. And it wants all different types of oil, not just high grade or crude. In fact, nothing wants crude. It wants low, mid, and high. And you're kind of hedging your bet with those contracts, because if you don't complete them, they go away and you get a penalty marker, the same as if you take a loan, you get a penalty marker. And then there are orders, and I might have, you have orders that are out for everybody, first come, first serve. As soon as you complete an entire order, you get all the money for that, so you're kind of focusing on that. So you go through, you take all these actions, there's a lot of choices, a lot of options, so strategy is not something I can really get into. And at the end of the game, you score. You score based on, there's like one tile that always scores. You score for all of your pipes for how well they can produce things. And then there's random cards. I think I counted like 15 cards, and you put three out every game, so that's going to change it up for other conditions. The initial game tells you kind of like, put these cards out, which kind of double score. Like, I'm going to score for pipes and then score for them again. The machines were the parts we didn't really get into, but at the end of every turn, you can pay $15 to run all of your pipes from the machines, which is really powerful, but it's going to cost you a lot of money, and you can't run your pipes otherwise. So it's really having you create that system and do a good job with it. Anyway, like I said, it's going to take, like, I really enjoyed my one play, and I feel like I understood a lot, but there was a lot more to go after, upgrades and machines and all sorts of other things, and thinking about endgame scoring more, it just happened. But it's a really good game. It's a really good economic Euro game. Like I said, it's not high in the interaction. It doesn't have auctioning or stock or anything like that in it, like an 18XX or another Euro game, economic game would have in it. But it's good, and it's a strong contender. The potential of this game is really high, so I have to see how much more I get to play it. But this could kind of, this right now is my meaty game of this year, like my really heavy game that I'm enjoying from this year. I would put Underwater Cities here as well, though it's basically being counted as a 2018 game, even though it came out in 2019 in America from Rio Grande. So anyway, check it out if you're into this style game. Pipeline is really good. I know we've got Kickstarter copies at the store available because we backed that one and had a chance to play. And that is Pipeline from Capstone Games. Hey, I'm going to call it there for reviews for this one, but that's a lot of great games that I went through, a lot of popular games. But let me know what's on your table, what you've been playing. You can email me at portalgamepodcast@gmail.com, or better yet, you can hit me up on Twitter @portalgaming60. And we'll jump into our next segment. I'm not even going to put a space here. I'm looking at my battery on this, and it may die, so we'll see how we do. But, say lovey. So, what I wanted to do, I wanted to talk about six-player games. This I was inspired for two reasons. One, I just got a chance to play Trade on the Tigris, which is a game from Tasty Minstrel Games and Ryan Sturm and Jeff Engelstein, which was a game that they kind of began to jokingly invent or create based off of Tom Bassel saying, I don't want trading in the Mediterranean. They originally called the game Trading in the Mediterranean. But they were trying to just create a game that's just really all about trading. They put a little Civ flair to it. And it's a really cool engine-building game. Plays six players. That's what made me think about that. As well as someone posted on the Dice Tower page on Facebook, and they were saying, oh, we're going away with other couples, and we rented a Airbnb with a table big enough to play with six and big games. What should we play with six? Now, I don't know what they wanted, but I was trying to suggest a bunch of games, and I thought it'd be fun to talk about on here, because I feel like I'm in that boat sometimes, too. What do I play with six? Now, there's the beginning answer of playing Roll and Rights and playing party games and playing, other games of that type, which I think are perfectly fine to play. There's nothing wrong with playing Codenames with six players and playing other party-style games or Skull or other things like this, a Roll and Write game that plays that number count, because that's what those games do. Oh, social deduction games are great for this, and that's what they're intended to do. They're intended to play better with higher player counts. There's so many of those that are great, I can't run through them all, but they're not always what I want to do. I know at my house sometimes I'll have five or six people, and they're all people who are interested in playing a medium-weight Euro or a longer 2-hour style game or whatever, And so we're not always looking to play those. So we're either breaking up into groups or we're looking for these types of games. So I wanted to run through some games that I think are a little bit, you know, heavier, I guess, or they're good strategy games that play with six players, or they play best at six. So a perfect example of that would be Twilight Rex, or even Twilight Struggle for that matter, Twilight Imperium for that matter. But Twilight Rex is a six-player game set in the Twilight Imperium universe. That's a rehashing of Dune, which is now coming out from Gale Force 9 this year. And it's kind of like a game of deception and alliance and breaking alliance. And it's got a lot of little rules going on. And that's a game that just is kind of asking you to play with six in terms of that. Another one would be like the Game of Thrones game plays really well at six in terms of that. But you're talking about a very long day. But that would be another one that would work well there. So let me just run through what I have here. So the first one I mentioned, Trade on the Tigris. I think this game's going to be best at six. It's just more trading, more going on, because it's just a round where you just have 5 minutes and you just trade whatever you can trade. What's really smart in that game is these development cards you get every round for your government and your religion. This is a game where you fully are talking about government and religion, but they did a great job making it very, like the religion that I don't think they are is Ashur and Marduk, and I don't think they exist. As far as I know, I could be wrong. As religion, so it's not a major feature of that. But they give you these development cards every turn, so you kind of have like a mini engine building civ, like your civilization's building stronger, and I thought that was really fun. So check that one out. I think that was last year. This next one, Decrypto, is kind of a party style game. I believe this is Yellow Games. Yeah, it is. And it really is a party-style game. It's like a word game. You're writing things out and all of that. It really plays best with six. This game really wants you to play six players and whatnot. It's teams of three, and the idea is your team can see your own code words, and they're numbered, and you're trying to give clues to your teammates so that they will guess the numbers. It's a really hard game to explain. I remember explaining on the podcast prior. So essentially, if I was trying to get my team to say monkey, bread, and game, I might, for monkey, I might give them the word banana, which would also work for bread, so it's probably not a great clue. For bread, I might say toast, and for game, I might say dice tower. I don't know, that's a terrible clue, but you get my point. So I'll say these three code words, and the other team gets those, and then my team guesses what they think it is. The other team also gets a chance to guess first what they think the three numbers are. So what happens over time is monkey, I might say banana, jungle, whatever other word, cage, things like this. And they start to say, we don't know what that word is, but it's something to do with an animal that lives in the jungle, that eats, you know, it sounds like monkey. And they start to get a better clue because they're kind of intercepting those. One team wins either when a team, so one team will lose. It's always interesting. You always win not on your turn. So you can lose, I think. Anyway, you lose by guessing your own clues wrong twice. You win by guessing the other team's right twice. And that's it. Yeah. Anyway, it's a really good game. It's really complicated to explain, and people really have to jump in. It's probably a game that the first time you play, it's worth just saying, let's play around a fake round, and then does it make sense? And now let's play for real, if you wanted to, because that would probably work a little bit better. But I really like it, and as much as it is kind of a party word game, it's definitely thinkier than that. It's quieter. Like, the table's kind of quiet. So it's a good thinking game with six to crypto, and works best that way. Next up is Downforce. This is the racing game from Restoration Games. This game is awesome. It is especially awesome with six. You auction off cars, and then you race them around, and it's really neat because you get to place bets. And you can pay very little, and you can move whatever cars you want. It's just very well done. The hardest part is teaching the auction, which has to happen first. I, you know, playing this game with people who all know it, and you just, boom, do the auction. It's just great because the game is just really fast. And again, fast is good here. Really fun. It almost starts to feel like a party game in that sense because, yeah, you want to win and you're picking smart things, but you're okay just having a good time playing this game and probably playing multiple rounds of it. But that's Downforce from Restoration Games. Really, really fun. Next up, I haven't actually gotten a chance to play it, but I will still recommend it because I'm sure it is good. And that is Concordia, specifically Concordia Venus, which now plays six players with partners. And I've heard how the partners work, and I think it'll be great. And Concordia is just an amazing, amazing, amazing game. And I think this would really be, you know, you've got, like this person was asking for couples going away for a gaming weekend. Okay, you've got time, you've got energy, you've got space, you know, whatever to do this. So I think this would be a really viable choice to play because it's a great game and whatnot. I don't know if you can play with six without partners, but I would think so. It would just be a little bit longer. I don't know the length on the game, but hey, it'd be really good. Speaking of games that would be very long, and they're not necessarily like my favorites to play with these numbers, but I know that people really like them, so I would suggest them because a lot of people have fun, would be Scythe and Caverna. So Scythe, big game from Stonemaier Games, kind of like a Euro trash-style game where you're moving around with mechs and scoring points and whatnot. To me, it would be a little bit of a train wreck with six players, I would think, but I know a lot of people play the Scythe. They love it. I think six is kind of where it peaks. I think it can go to seven, but I don't think anybody wants to do that. So six might be a little overwrought in terms of that. I played a six-player game. Yeah, and it wasn't too bad. I mean, it probably came in at 2.5-3 hours, and it was fine in terms of that. And Caverna would be the same. You'd be adding players. This game's probably best at, like, 2, 3, 4, but it plays up to seven. And I did play a six-player game of this, which actually wasn't too bad. It really requires you to go, 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 go. And now I'm thinking about it, I think the other one that would fall into this category would be Viticulture, which is also from Stonemaier. Sorry, Caverna's Uwe Rosenberg, and it was published by Mayfair and Lookout, which means it must be under Z-Man. So it's probably Asmodee now. And Viticulture strikes me. That plays with six. In fact, one time I played, somebody did do the go, 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 and it worked well. It made players really play. Blue, your turn, go. Green, your turn, go. And it worked well. Like, it is kind of a calmer game than that, but we managed to get through the game in like 2 hours, which was fun. So those are some games that aren't necessarily my favorites, but I know people really like them, and they play with six and probably would play well. All right, jumping back into stuff I really like. Byzance is a little auction card game. It's really fun. It's from Renegade Game Studios. I think it's Lotta Pellet. Lotta Pellet? I can't remember the name exactly. But it's this little, like, auction game where you're spending cards as your auction. Like, oh, I'm going to spend four of this resource to gain this. And the earlier I auction for things, I get benefits. And the later I get benefits. It's really clever. It's really well done. It runs a little long. It's probably 45 minutes to an hour. Comes in a little box. The artwork is fine. It's a little cartoony. It's just kind of standard. I don't know. It almost reminds me of like Sunday school artwork. Like, it looks like people drawn of that style and just some items. But it's really fun. It plays six and would play really well with, does play really well with six. That's probably a better count in terms of what you're doing here. Next up, huge game, Heroes of Land, Air, and Sea. Now, the nice part with this is it'll play six. It'll play six really well. Your time frame would be based on who's new. So if it's a bunch of new players, then your time's really going to jump up to 4+ hours. We did a big recap of this with a six-player game. It's probably a little better at 4 and 5 than it is at 6. But you could totally play at 6 and it's fun. It's not going to be bad. And if everybody knows it, you're really going to knock this game out in like 2.5 hours. It's going to be perfect. So that would be really good. A couple smaller games. These probably run into the party category, but I put them on here anyway because they're two of my favorite drafting games. Ion from Genius Games and Sushi Go, or Sushi Go Party, which obviously that makes it a party game. But they're drafting games. They are light. They're whimsical. They're probably in the 15 to 20 minute range for actually playing the games out. Ion is neat because you can kind of up the complexity by adding more things to it, which is really nice. Sushi Go is neat because you can change up everything with Sushi Go Party or Sushi Go. I always just tell people to buy that. I love this with Sushi Go. Actually, what I've done with people is I like Sushi Go Party better, but it's more complex to set up, where Sushi Go, you just
grab the deck, shuffle, and go. So I always tell people, buy Sushi Go, learn it, love it, then buy Sushi Go Party and give away your copy of Sushi Go to somebody else. Because Sushi Go Party has all the same stuff as Sushi Go. And I think that's a great way to kind of just spread the cheer of that game. But those will play well with six. Ooh, you know what? Sushi Go. Does Sushi Go play with six? It might only be Sushi Go Party that plays with six. I don't know. Anyway, plays with six. Shadows Over Camelot's kind of a cool, like, co-op. Six player, you could put a trader in there. Kind of an older game, but it works really well with six people. In fact, better, because you just have more to manage and worry about. Yeah, that's a neat game. Great production from Days of Wonder back in the, like, heyday of Days of Wonder. They're still solid. They're still good, but, their production's still way up there, but the games just haven't been as good lately as that. And good old Seven Wonders. Seven Wonders really plays well at a lot of counts. The beauty of Seven Wonders is everybody plays simultaneously. That's probably the drafting game you're going for in terms of gamers and all that. A couple others that I could think that are sitting on my shelf, like Card Games Fantasy Realms is really good with six and whatnot. And then I could rifle through party games and Roll and Rights and all sorts of other things that would play well. But yeah. Let me know. Email me, portalgamingpodcast@gmail.com or @portalgaming60 on Twitter, and tell me some of your favorite six-player, specifically strategy games. What did I miss? What am I not thinking of? I know there's a ton more. I'm just kind of going through the highlights of some of my favorites and whatnot. It's a tricky player count because there's a lot of games that maybe you could add, or the box says they go to six, but they don't play well at six, or they don't play in a reasonable amount of time. You get too much downtime. But these are ones that I would say do, or I know people that really like them at those counts. So there you go. That's an episode. That's episode 128 of the Portal Gaming Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I think my next episode will be snippets from Dice Tower Con, interviews of people, publishers, and content creators, and just general riffraff that I run into down in Orlando. Looking forward to playing a bunch of games, teaching a bunch of games, just kind of hanging out down there. I'm kind of doing a short jaunt, like 3 days, not doing the full con, just to be home with the family. Yeah, thanks so much for listening. I am your host, The Brain, and until next time, I hope you step.